This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Bush has outlined his plan to help senior citizens with their prescription drug costs. In a speech to the American Medical Association yesterday, he proposed three options. The first would allow seniors to stay in the current government-run Medicare system and get a discount card for prescription drugs. Another option is similar to a preferred provider setup. It offers seniors a more comprehensive drug benefit at a somewhat higher cost. And the third option would be to offer prescription drug benefits within the context of private managed care plans. Now, wait a minute. Did he say managed care? Isn't that the insurance solution that was supposed to save healthcare 10 years ago only to become the bad guy? Well, while Congress takes up the debate on how to meet the prescription drug needs of seniors, we're going to step back and check in on managed care. Who uses it? Who's happy with it? Who's not? What lessons have been learned from the mistakes of managed care? And is it still a viable way to provide health care? In other words, is it part of the solution or is it part of the problem? We want to hear from you today. Do you use managed care? How does it work for you? Do you work in health care and have experience with managed care? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us is Uwe Reinhardt, a professor of healthcare economics at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson Center. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Let's get to some of the terminology straight right from the beginning. We toss the words managed care and HMO around, but these aren't really the same thing, are they?
Well, they should be the same thing, but they are not. Managed care, in the end, was so loose a term, it described nothing. What policy analysts had meant by managed care is that you chose an insurance company that would offer against a premium an integrated delivery system to you. They would contract or own hospitals or contract with hospitals and physicians. You would have a primary care physician who would essentially be your consultant and ombudsman and would arrange referrals to the hospital or to specialists. And there would be integrated patient files so that everyone could get access to these files who treats you, subject to privacy laws. The classic case is the Kaiser Foundation, Kaiser Permanente Health Plan, created during World War II to deliver efficient health care. That is still the model. You also have Puget Sound in Seattle. But basically, one thinks Kaiser. Those are the classic managed care companies.
Well, World War II, why was Kaiser Permanente, what became Kaiser Permanente, why was it created and how did it become such a big model?
It was created because Henry Kaiser, of course, was one of America's great entrepreneurs who built the ships that carried the troops and their supplies, and he needed good and efficient health care. And there was a physician, Sidney Garfield, I think his name was, who had begun to build prepaid group practices, so it wasn't fee-for-service. You paid a premium, and from then on, you were covered, and the physicians were salaried employees of the group practice. And during the war, in a pinch, when labor was scarce and we couldn't waste resources, Henry Kaiser turned to Sidney Garfield and said, "Build me a thing like that for my workers." And that's how Kaiser grew.
So as Henry Kaiser revolutionized the shipbuilding industry to build the Liberty and Victory ships in World War II, similarly, this system revolutionized healthcare.
Yes, he did, accidentally, but nevertheless, he did.
Now, you also mentioned an expression in there, fee-for-service. Now, fee-for-service is, I've got pneumonia, I go to the doctor, he gives me some pills, I pay for the pills at the pharmacy, and the doctor sends me a bill, and that's that.
Yeah. And the fee-for-service, the patient or their insurer are fully at risk. In a good managed care company, ideally, the provider system should be at risk. So they should search for the most efficient way, integrated way to treat a patient. And I believe Kaiser does that. I think very highly of Kaiser.
Now, then you get into another situation after, because Kaiser was obviously a private plan.
It was, yes.
And when do you start getting the government involved?
Well, the government does not get involved other than paying the premium on behalf of citizens to Kaiser. There are federal employees in California who are enrolled in Kaiser, and the federal government pays the bulk of the premium. That's the only involvement government has.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you have other plans other than Kaiser that have developed.
There were other plans, and the problem was that every time Dick and Harry got into this act, people who really weren't clinically oriented, they were just business people trying to make a fast buck. And it is really these fly-by-night outfits that gave it a bad name. And then I would add, there were some large traditional insurance companies who were good in this piece rate fee-for-service. They were bill-paying mm-hmm. organizations, and they thought they could get into managed care and made a mess of it. They thought they could do what Kaiser did, but Kaiser developed this model over 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And these fly-by-night, and these were well-known insurance companies who basically didn't know how to manage care, but called themselves that. And it is they who gave the enterprise a bad name in the in their early learning phases.
Are we naming names here?
I could. I would say the early Aetna, Metropolitan Life, even some of the Blue Cross plans just were not structured to really deliver good managed care. That doesn't mean they couldn't have learned to do this, but the backlash killed this enterprise before they had a chance to learn it.
Okay.
But they went about it very often in a somewhat klutzy way. Kaiser doesn't treat doctors with disrespect. These insurance companies often did.
Now, there are now a variety of plans available, right? Not just a straight we pay one fee, and there are all these PPOs, EPOs.
Yeah. Now, a PPO is really warmed over. It's really fee-for-service in drag, so to speak. It's still piece rate, where the incentive on the provider side is the more they do, the more money they make.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference between a completely open-ended fee-for-service is that there is a network of preferred doctors and hospitals, and so if you go to them as a patient, your cost sharing is lower than it would be if you go outside the network. But by and large, PPOs do not control health spending very well.
Now, EPOs, that's sort of a mélange, if you will, a mixture.
Yeah.
And you have a restricted list of physicians you go to and more coverage than you would under a PPO, but not as much as you would under a straight HMO.
Right. These are really shades of managing. See, an HMO, because the provider system is at risk, will, in fact, at the fringes, ration in the sense that things that seem useless or have very low clinical value, they will not do.
Now, how is it that such a large percentage of Americans now find themselves in one form or another of managed care?
Well, for one, very often they're not, or if they're in it, they don't know. There was a survey done not long ago where people were asked, are you in managed care? And they said no. Then they were asked, what do you think of managed care? And they hated it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a terrible system. And then they were asked, well, what is your insurance policy? And it turns out they were in managed care. They just didn't know it. So, you know, this happens. There are very few people in truly, genuinely managed care in really well-run HMOs. Actually, very few Americans are in those. Most of them are in insurance companies that got discounts from doctors and hospitals. And getting a discount, they call that managing care. And that's kind of, to me, a sloppy definition of managed care. It means I do something other than simply blindly pay any bill shoved under my nose. If I look at the bill, I call it managed care. Most of the people who said we are a managed care company were anything but. They were basically just, as I say, fee-for-service bill payers in drag.
But there are many, many employers in this country who have these policies that they make available to their employees, and in one form or another, these people are in one of these programs.
That's right, and think they're in managed care and wonder why premiums go up a lot, because, in fact, the product is not managed.
What percentage of the American public is in these kinds of programs at this point?
Well, if you take the loose definition, which is about as loose as saying animal when I want to describe a schnauzer, the loose definition, it's something like 70 or 80%. I mean, basically now, almost every insurance company will sit and negotiate fees with doctors and hospitals. Most of them do not control volume at all. But in the 70s and 80s, the insurance companies didn't even negotiate fees. They simply paid whatever they were billed. So in the same medical arts building, you had two internists, and one got 50% more from the same insurance company than the other, simply because they billed different amounts. That we don't have anymore.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about the history, the performance, and the future of HMOs and managed care with Uwe Reinhardt of Princeton University. Our first caller is Tim, who's on the line with us from Bayfield, Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm glad I'm able to talk here. I have some strong feelings about managed care. I'm a professional. I'm a clinical social worker, and I have my own outpatient mental health center. And one of the things with managed care, I take less of a fee, so it can be affordable for people to have good health insurance or medical coverage. In September or October of 2001, my professional newsletter, what came across was managed care salaries. And for instance, the largest paid or the largest amount paid to an individual was the CEO of the Minneapolis-based United Healthcare Group, William McGuire. He took home $54.1 million. And my feeling about that is that this person took home that amount in 1 year. It doesn't feel right to me. Nobody has a right to make that in a year, not even a lifetime, in my opinion. And here, when I try to get on the phone and I try to clarify or get information from that organization, I'm on hold for 20, 25 minutes, while this guy is taking money at the top, so much money, then the people at the bottom there aren't available. Now, my thought is if we're all going to take less money, the physicians, the dentists, the mental health profession, I think that we should put a ceiling on executives. Who has a right to take home that amount of money for that short time?
Hmm. Well, Uwe Reinhardt, are CEOs overpaid?
I think they are. There are two parts to my answer. First of all, I think American CEOs are wildly overpaid. They have a system going where they do service, what their colleagues make, and then they want to be in the 75th percentile of that distribution. I think what executives in America make is much too much relative to what everyone else makes. Having said that, however, Bill McGuire's salary, if you actually look carefully, his salary that he gets, which gets charged to the company and becomes part of the premium, is probably $1 million or something like that. The other $53 million would be taken not from patients, but from other shareholders through restricted stock grants or stock option grants. In other words, most of the money the CEOs of America have made have come at the expense of investors, of their shareholders. So if you are a shareholder of United, you could get mad at this. But if you are an insured person, it didn't come out of your pocket. But it really doesn't figure into the premium that we pay. It really lowers the rate of return to investors in United. But having said that...
We're going to have to wait until the after the break to hear the rest of the comments. So, Tim, we'll put you on hold, and we'll come back with the rest of the answer in just a moment. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about managed care health plans. Do you have any experience with managed care? Are you satisfied with it? What changes do you think that the system needs? Our phone number is 800-989-TALK, and the email address again is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Uwe Reinhardt, who's the professor of healthcare economics at Princeton University. We should mention that we called the two major associations that represent managed care companies, and they were unable to provide us with a guest. But anyway, we did have Tim on the line from Bayfield, Wisconsin. And Uwe Reinhardt, you were finishing your conclusion to his question about the exceptionally high level of pay that some CEOs get.
Yes. I mean, obviously, it is troublesome that we are creating this new corporate aristocracy whose children and grandchildren will forever get a different deal in American life. I agree with that, but it doesn't really affect healthcare very much at all. It has nothing to do with what patients experience or providers experience.
Tim?
Well, I heard the explanation that his salary wasn't really $54 million, but according to my newsletter here, it was, and he had unexercised stock options of $357 million.
Yes, correct. That's true. I'm sure.
But he. My understanding, that's what he took home. That was his salary.
No. Board would vote for that much salary.
Okay.
I would bet a lot of money on it.
Okay.
$54 million?
No, that's just much too much.
And Princeton doesn't pay that much either, right?
Then the top ten, the average CEO took home over $11 million. And they had stock
including options
of $68 million. I just think if we're going to do managed care, we're going to try to lower the cost. I think we need to put a ceiling on the CEOs, the executives.
Okay, Tim, thanks very much for the call.
You betcha.
Uwe Reinhardt, during the 90s, a lot of people credited managed care, HMOs, with restraining the great leap forward and, you know, the huge double-digit increases in health care costs in the late 80s. Is that accurate?
I believe it is. Now, there are people who would dispute it, but I think if you look at the premiums, in 1988, they rose 18%, HMO premiums even, for large companies. And then came managed care, and premiums in the mid-90s were flat. They didn't grow up at all. Now, something must have caused that. And I think it was all of these traditional insurance companies who morphed into managed care companies, but only to the extent that they bargained for discounts. And that is why providers are so disenchanted with managed care, because there is no question their income was hit, because these guys were bargaining for prices, got 30-40% discounts, and particularly in the mental health field, got huge discounts. And the providers of these services were squeezed. And that is part of the managed care backlash. Actually, in terms of cutting utilization, the managed care companies did very little. They didn't know how to do it. B, they were scared of getting sued. And C, by the time they started doing it, the backlash was on.
Our next caller is Matthew, who's on the line with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello. I just have two comments. The first one is related to the previous caller. And I worked in managed care and insurance companies for over 10 years and ultimately left the field about 3 years ago because I came to disagree that there should be a profit motive associated with delivering health care. In reference to the previous caller, I wholeheartedly agree that the professionals are underpaid, and that when they read about high salaries for healthcare executives, it must be a bitter pill to swallow. My second comment has to do with criticism that managed care employees receive in the media. The soundbite tends to be that bureaucrats are making decisions for delivering medical care, but I think the reality is that nurses are supervising claims examiners, and those nurses are supervised by medical directors who are physicians. And those, in my experience, those individuals were never pressured to make decisions based on profits or for any other reason except to deliver care. So that's my comment, and I'll take any response off the air.
Okay, Matthew. Thanks very much. Any response, Uwe?
I agree that most managed care companies, I know a lot of medical directors of these companies, they faced a monumental task. They really did try to deliver good health care. Even United, I mean, you can say whatever you want about the salary, but I know United has a huge research arm that searches for best practices. For example, United, it was Lee Newcomer, who was medical director of United, published an article where he found that only half the patients got the right medicine after a heart attack. He could tell that from the billing files. They didn't get beta blockers. And so he published an article and drew the nation's attention to it, and they created a research company to make sure that all the physicians who work for them prescribe the right drugs, and they're now up to 90%. So these medical directors are actually much more like social workers and physicians and not profit-maximizing people. The image that these companies endanger patients for profit, I think it's wrong. There may have been occasionally some fly-by-night outfit, but good companies like Humana or United don't do this. Don't ever forget, Neil, what we do forget, under the old fee-for-service system, there was a huge incentive to overtreat patients, including, it is at least alleged, to do operations that were not necessary. There's a lot of research in the 80s that something like 25% of all the pacemakers that were implanted, clinical experts said were not necessary. And those patients are in danger, too. You cut somebody open to put a pacemaker in, that has dangers to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the press never reported, oddly, on the over-servicing of patients and the dangers of that, only when there might have been some underserving. I agree with the previous caller. The workers for the managed care company got a bum rap.
Yeah, at the same time, though, a lot of us hear these horror stories of patients who want some even mildly experimental, bone marrow transplant or something like that, and the mean old managed care company says, no, this is not necessary medical care. We're not going to pay for it.
Well, speaking of bone marrow transplant, the first major legal suit was against a company called HealthNet, and they got nailed for $92 million for having denied a lady with breast cancer the bone marrow transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it turned out there was a huge study directed by the University of Pittsburgh. It is now generally agreed that this is an inappropriate procedure. It's a very troublesome, painful procedure, and it doesn't work. So it turns out the HMO's medical director was simply ahead of what is now generally accepted. So you can always find horror stories, I'm sure, but what I'm saying is, what about the horror stories of unnecessary surgery? I could show you reputable, peer-reviewed studies that showed that something like 20% of coronary bypasses that were done in the 80s were unnecessary. Now, a coronary bypass, that is one hell of a lot of plumbing. Imagine the suffering that when it wasn't necessary.
Joining us now from his office in Charlottesville, Virginia, is Jeff Goldsmith, who's a healthcare consultant and industry forecaster. Welcome.
Thank you.
You've been involved in the healthcare industry for over 25 years, the problems that HMOs have experienced. How many of them are self-inflicted, in your view?
Well, I think this is an industry that was thrust onto the public stage by the Nixon administration. I mean, there were less than 10 million people in health maintenance organizations as late as 1980, and the federal government actually put out grants and loans to try and grow the number of health plans that were out there, because federal policymakers wanted this industry to flourish, and they ultimately wanted it to be used to help publicly funded patients in the Medicare and Medicaid programs. I think the problems arose that this industry was unprepared for the rapid growth. Enrollment tripled in the 1980s, and then it quadrupled on top of that in the 1990s. And I think a lot of these companies just did a terrible job of scaling up and, creating systems to manage their relationships to the people that enrolled in them and their relationships to doctors and hospitals.
Are they learning?
I think they're learning fast. I think this is an industry that just got scorched during the late 1990s, not only by hostile press, but by Wall Street. And I certainly see aggressive efforts being made to try and modernize their business operations and to change the way in which they create value for their subscribers. If they can't create value for the people that are enrolled in their plans to justify the 10 to 15% or whatever it is that is taken before providers are paid for caring for them, they really don't have a future as an industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of things that these plans are doing to try and change, not only change their business model, but change the relationship to their customer.
Uwe Reinhardt, you wrote, or you said, or we played a clip of tape earlier in the program, where you said that in the late 1990s, managed care managed to irritate almost every single constituent group.
Well, you have to understand that they would irritate the doctors was clear. We should have expected that. I think a lot of patients who were in managed care, got wonderful care, thought they weren't in managed care, nevertheless badmouthed managed care because they read it in USA Today or other media outlets. The managed care, as I said earlier, and I totally agree with Jeff, they did a lot of klutzy things. For example, kicking mothers out of bed after 24 hours in the hospital. That may be clinically sound, but it wasn't consumer-oriented. So in the late 90s, many of us talked to these companies and said, you thought your customer was your employer and not the employee, but what you have to do is to become more friendly to them, provide information to them, provide services to them. And I think the industry is retooling. I personally believe managed care will be back.
Well, these companies cannot survive as a black box. It just no one was going to tolerate the idea that some shadowy medical director in an office building in Connecticut was going to tell you in Charlottesville or Toledo, Ohio, what you needed. I think the perception that that's what these firms was doing was very damaging to them politically and as businesses.
And the interesting thing is that it was much more perception than reality. There was a study done at Harvard, and they showed only 1% of the time did an HMO actually deny a proposed therapeutic strategy.
Yeah, but those were the news stories in the made-for-TV movies.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But for every denial, there were 20 instances where doctors or patients had to hop through a bunch of hoops.
Yes.
To get a procedure authorized or green-lighted or whatever you want to call it. And I think just the sheer magnitude of the hassle involved played a large role
in
public service.
That is why United was the first to stop doing this one-on-one utilization review and go more to what Canadians actually use or others, which is profiling doctors, where you do statistical profiles and say, how does this doctor typically treat patients? And you find one always x-rays everyone, and the other one doesn't, and yet the outcome seems similar.
Hmm.
And then you go talk to them and say, why do you x-ray all the time? And very often, physicians, when you tell them that, will adjust their behavior. There's some evidence, quite a bit, that when physicians are shown that they're outliers in treating patients, they will adjust their behavior, and much more peacefully than if you, on each transaction, ask for pre-authorization, concurrent authorization, and sort of intrude daily into the doctor's and patient's life.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller involved. Laura joins us now on the line from Damariscotta, Maine.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling for all the private practitioners who have basically been driven out of business by managed care. I had a practice in Vermont that served a pretty underserved rural population, and as of last November, I closed my practice and moved to Maine because I was unable to get reimbursed, basically.
Because of that paperwork problem?
Well, yes, it was definitely paperwork. I paid more to the person who did my billing than I kept for myself. And it It just was a very unhappy situation all the way around for my clients, for me. It's absolutely impossible to stay on top of how to do the billing, given all the different managed care companies and all the different rules and all the different forms and authorizations and timing of such, even with computer programs to try to help. I just want to say that I think there are a lot of good clinicians who don't have MBAs and aren't interested in doing billing who are no longer in the field, and that's a real loss.
Well, it's an absolute tragedy, and, you know, I think what's even more tragic is that the technology to make authorizing and paying you as simple as purchasing a shirt exists, and it just has been like pulling teeth to get, you know, the insurance companies to standardize what it is that they want from you.
Well, that, and when you call them, you never get the same person twice, and once you've made an error of perhaps maybe one number on a HCFA form, it sort of goes into some unknown place where trying to get back to it is nearly impossible.
Well,
so I have bills that are, I haven't billed for clients for the last half of last year just because I gave up.
Right. Well, you see, this is part of American culture in general, this pluralism, that everyone has to have their own deal. That's why cell phones don't work in this country when they do work in Europe. And in the insurance industry, we are the last bastion of paper in the insurance world. In every other country, people bill electronically. In every other country, physicians prescribe electronically. Only in the U.S. is paper still worshipped the way we do. And I'm on the board of the Duke University Medical System. I was told that our billing department has several hundred people in it just to bill for our hospital. And it should be basically no people. It should be computers
that do
most of it.
That happened to me at the small hospital in Vermont that I worked at. It made the CEO of the hospital furious that the mental health billing couldn't go, you know, it wasn't going through, and that we weren't turning a profit, even though we were working more hours and seeing more people.
And I'm afraid, won't get any better, and under the president's proposal to privatize Medicare, will get a lot worse for the elderly.
And that's what we're going to have to talk about.
Excuse me, Jeff.
I'm afraid we're running out of time.
Right.
And we're going to talk about that in our next segment when we come back. But I wanted to thank, first of all, Laura, appreciate your call. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Jeff Goldsmith, thank you very much. Jeff Goldsmith is a healthcare consultant and industry forecaster, was on the line with us from Charlottesville, Virginia. And Uwe Reinhardt of Princeton University, you've been very good to spend time with us. Today we're talking about managed care, and for the next few minutes we'll talk about President Bush's proposal to offer a prescription drug benefit to Medicare beneficiaries if they switch to private insurance plans, including HMOs. Critics say the plan forces the nation's elderly and disabled into managed care and still doesn't offer enough drug benefits. Joining us now is Tricia Newman, Vice President of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, which I should note is not connected with the well-known HMO Kaiser Permanente. Tricia Newman heads up the foundation's Medicare Policy Project. She joins us here in Studio 3A, and good of you to come in.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about what President Bush is proposing. He wants to give all seniors prescription drug coverage, but that would be more generous if people move into HMOs or PPOs. Tell us what he said.
That's right. Those seniors who stay in traditional Medicare can get the fee-for-service program, can get some help with their drug costs through a discount drug card or through a catastrophic benefit. What that means is if they have extraordinarily high drug costs, they could get some help from the government. But to get more generous coverage or to get a real drug benefit like many people get today, they would need to move into a private plan like an HMO, a health maintenance organization, or another type of private health plan.
Now, how many people are currently in Medicare?
41 million are currently in Medicare, and of that group, 9 out of 10 are still in the fee-for-service program.
Okay. Now, does Medicare provide a prescription drug benefit at this time?
No. Most people... Medicare does not provide prescription drugs, although some people do get drug coverage from other sources.
Mm-hmm. Now, anyone with elderly grandparents or parents, it's just to look in the medicine cabinet to figure out that it's usually pretty full of bottles of drugs. So in other words, seniors are high users of prescription drugs.
This is a huge issue for seniors. It's something that everybody talks about. It's something that members of Congress hear when they go back and listen to their seniors. People are struggling with their bills. Even those who have some kind of supplemental coverage find that their coverage doesn't go far enough, and they're paying more and more each year. We've done research that shows that seniors are skipping medicine, splitting their pills, not filling their prescriptions, even those who are really sick and have serious health problems like heart disease, and it's a real problem out there.
We have an email from Paula, who wrote us earlier in the program, who wrote to say that she has nice things to say about her HMO. In part, she thinks because it's a nonprofit. But her other point is, she writes, President Bush is foolish if he thinks HMOs will even bother to take on Medicare again if changes in payments aren't made. HMOs have been forced to drop senior coverage because it was costing them money. It was not something they've wanted to do but had to do just to survive. Is that right?
Well, I think she's right. Changes would have to be made. There have been a number of plans that have pulled out of Medicare in recent years. The number of plans serving Medicare beneficiaries has dropped by more than a third, leaving more than 2 million people to scramble for their coverage. So something would have to change in order to keep health plans serving Medicare and to come on and be a good source of drug coverage.
So what would be the incentive if, on the other hand, looking at it from the HMO's point of view, what's their incentive to take on drug plans for elderly patients who use a lot of drugs?
Well, you know, these health plans are businesses, and like any business, they would be looking to earn a reasonable profit and make money on this line of business. So they're looking to expand their markets. And if payments from the federal government would be adequate, that they would find this to be a good line of business to mm-hmm. come into.
Any idea what those payment levels would be set at? I don't think President Bush went into that level of detail
yesterday. There's not many of the details are not yet known, including how much the government would be paying plans, what the benefit looks like. And that's another real important issue for people who go into these private plans. They'll want to know, what's their drug benefit? What premium do they pay? How much protection do they get? What do they have to pay when they go to fill their prescription at the pharmacy?
In his State of the Union address, President Bush said, and I'm quoting here, instead of bureaucrats and trial lawyers and HMOs, we must put doctors and nurses and patients back in charge of American medicine. So is this consistent with now his suggestion that HMOs are a better way to provide prescription drug benefits for Medicare patients?
Well, this is clearly expanding the role of private plans and giving strong incentives for seniors to leave traditional fee-for-service Medicare, where they can choose their doctors and hospitals, and go into private plans. Some of these plans will be HMOs, as envisioned. Others might be what's called preferred provider organizations, mm-hmm. where there would be a more limited list of the doctors that they could go see. And in those cases, the plan might have more say over how the benefits are structured and what they would get.
Is offering these idea of choice, I mean, on the surface of it, we all like choice.
Everybody likes choice. The idea of choice sounds really great, and I think, you know, it's kind of American. We all like choices.
Sure.
But I think for this population, when they hear the word choice, they may be thinking choose their own doctors rather than choose between competing health plans. The idea of choosing between health plans might have some greater benefit, but it's not something that you often hear seniors saying that they'd like to be able to do. They want help with their drug costs. They want to be able to get good coverage.
There has always been a lot of emotion on this subject, and you know, people are, as you say, easily confused over what their choices are, and nobody wants to change something that they think is working. We all remember the ads of, you know, I don't want to be forced to leave the doctor I've been with, you know, last 15 years.
Well, I think it's a real issue, and it's a real issue for seniors today who, or seniors any day, I guess,
mm-hmm. yeah.
who tend to have lots of health problems, close ties to their doctors. They often see many specialists, and change is disturbing and can be a particular problem. We saw a few years ago when many of the Medicare HMOs pulled out of the Medicare program, that caused a lot of anxiety and turbulence for seniors who were concerned that they wouldn't get coverage. Luckily, they had traditional Medicare to fall back on, but there was a lot of anxiety.
We have a caller. Lynn joins us on the line from Pageland, South Carolina.
Good afternoon. I absolutely oppose the president's ideas of going ahead and putting people that are in Medicare and opting out for HMOs. My husband is in a retail corporation, and presently we are enlisted in an HMO. I'm going for a disabilities hearing in May, and I have an attorney, and everything seems to be going really well toward a positive result in getting the disability. Recently, actually, as of yesterday, we had a major disaster with our HMO, and it has been going on for almost 2 years. The average time it's been taking them to pay on just a simple office visit is 4 months. And long story short, they, the last major problem we've had with them, it has taken them 4 months to pay on simple payments that should have been made. We spent literally hours. I've logged in the hours I've spent with them on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday I received a call on our answering machine that they are sending us additional monies for the inconvenience, and they appreciate the fact that we have contacted our lawyers, but we hope that in sending us additional monies that we would be appeased.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like I've never been with an HMO that has done what they said they were going to do. They give you pamphlets and folders, and my husband came home with a book that might be, you know, 500 pages thick, and have diligently gone through as much as we could understand. They have not followed probably at least 75% of what is in that book.
Lynn, let me stop you there because we wanted to give a chance to get a reply from Tricia Newman. I mean,
I think you raise a really important point. For the system to work well, it really does need to be user-friendly, and it has to work for people without too much hard work that sounds like you've put into getting the finances to work well. And it needs to work well for people who are healthy. It needs to work for people who are sick, people with disabilities, in order for the program to be a success.
Right. Now, my husband...
But the one that... To get back to the idea of this program for seniors, Lynn,
right.
And this may not apply to your situation right. specifically, but the president is offering this as an option. He's not forcing anybody into an HMO.
Right. Well, my parents are at the point where they are, you know, using Medicare. My mother is going in for a simple cataract surgery on one eye next week. She has also gone through, I can't even tell mm-hmm. you, the red tape, the paperwork, just to get a physical exam to go and get this procedure done.
Yeah.
I was also told that we cannot opt out of this HMO because it is a federally mandated law. My husband is not being allowed by his, I don't know if it's the company or HMO, to get out of it.
Does that sound right, Tricia?
Well, I'm not sure what your situation is, but it does sound something that you might...
Yes. Well, we are retaining our attorney, definitely, because it just sounds like a sticky wicket.
Yeah.
I do have a solution for this.
Very quickly, because we've got to move on.
Okay. I've spent a lot of time in Canada, and I absolutely think that it is time for this country to go health coverage for everyone regardless. And Canada's system works wonderfully. I've seen it for disabled people, and I've seen it for babies. I've seen it for elderly that are on their deathbed. It works great, and I think that our senators and congressmen and our president should really take a clear look.
Okay, Lynn, thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye now.
And that's the Canadian system, the single-payer system, as it's known. That's not on the table, is it?
It's not, except if you think about Medicare. Medicare, in some sense, is a single-payer for the elderly population, and it is a program that people seem to enjoy. It has broad public support. Medicare today is, in some sense, a very successful single-payer program. I wanted to get back and comment because you made the you raised the point about the administration would not be forcing people into HMOs, and that's exactly right from what we can tell from mm-hmm. what the administration has said. But there really are strong incentives to move into private plans because people are so eager to get help with their drug costs. There will be a strong incentive to try to move where they can get some help. Mm. And it may be an HMO or it might be another type of private health plan, but I think people are really eager to find relief. And if it's in a private health plan under Medicare, they may well go in that direction if they can afford the premium.
Tricia Newman, thanks very much. Tricia Newman is Vice President of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, Director of their Medicare Policy Project. She was with us here in Studio 3A. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.